Welcome to the Solomon's Corner podcast. Today we're going to be talking about Jeremy Boring and prenups. We're going to be talking about IVF. We're going to be talking about mortal sins. And we're going to be talking about the book He Leadeth Me, which is the book that they're doing on the Halo app for Pray 40. So stick around and we'll talk about all these controversial things. And hopefully I don't make too many people mad. We'll see.
Welcome to the Solomon's Corner podcast, a place for thinkers. Join us as we explore the depths of theology, philosophy, and the Christian intellectual life.
All right, we're back. So I'm just going to say, I really actually feel like live stream is better. I feel like it's easier to feel like you're talking to people rather than just sitting here in your room looking at a camera, recording. But my goal is to keep this down to a less than an hour, and I'm pretty sure I'm going to be able to keep this around like 30 minutes, so we'll see what happens. But before we dive into the new segment that I have, which is the What Happened on X segment, love talking to people about what happened on X. That's usually what I talk to people about anyway. And if you're not on X, you're probably a communist. So I'm just going to say that right now. But there's forgiveness. So you can always sign up. You can always get on there. You can always find out what's going on, what's true in the world, what's fake news, all that good stuff. So this is a pretty casual podcast. I don't know if you can tell, but try to, you know, make it a fairly well done, well produced kind of thing to the best that I can as a one man show. I contract my wife out for voice work when I need her. But she might be coming on more often. But one of the things I wanted to talk about before we dive into what happened on X is the why podcasts actually matter and why and who should do them. There is a phenomenon happening where, you know, we're in a phenomenon. Like nothing, we've never been able to have access to this kind of information. People haven't been able to spin up a podcast or show like this ever. It's kind of a form of the printing press. You know, everybody's sharing their ideas. And the reality is, I was talking to several priests this week and several of my friends, and the conversation kept coming up like, why are you doing a podcast? And part of the reason why is because the reality is that this is just how people discover new things. Even myself, you know, I would have never considered myself ever even remotely becoming Catholic. And the investigation started because of a Pints with Aquinas episode with Scott Hahn. So, you know, the reality is that we just have the ability to engage so many more people with so many more ideas. And if Christians and thoughtful Christians, especially those with, you know, who have pursued advanced degrees like master's level or PhDs. And the reality is there's plenty of successful YouTubers and influencers without any of those. But if you've gotten the training, then this is the most natural place for you to go to vet your ideas, especially considering that the academy has pretty much not lived up to what its morals and virtues are. The idea that you would pursue truth, that it would develop your character, all of those things. But even more so, there was an evolutionary biologist, I believe, that was talking at one point who had said that the academy had basically died. And what he meant by that was that all of this, the research for the most part, was on a feedback loop. Like if you wanted to do any sort of real research, you were going to have to break out of the academic system, because that was the way that research used to be done, was that you would go and it was kind of an adventurous thing. There wasn't a lot of money. You try to find stuff that you could do to do your testing. But at the end of the day, the idea of science and investigation and research was to challenge the status quo, not keep it in place. And so the nature of the academy has become such that if you're not studying the things that they want you to study, according to this guy, then you're not going to get published. And everybody knows in the academy that you got to publish or die. And especially considering some of the salaries you have, you better publish some books too. You're not going to just be able to publish your papers. But the nature of this whole thing led me to the conclusion that if you really care about the truth, if you really want to feel like you can test your ideas out, first and foremost, you should put them in this format or on a blog or something like that, because that does get you almost immediate feedback of how this would be received in the culture. And if you're not developing your ideas to influence others, meaning they're just for you, well, that's selfish if it's the truth, number one. But number two, you could find yourself in an echo chamber thinking that your arguments and your ideas are really airtight, when in actuality, they're not. And even still, you wouldn't necessarily find yourself being rebutted with, 10,000 trolls on your YouTube channel, because, after all, that's a lot of what happens. But the amount of times that you engage with thoughtful accounts or on X or whatever, if you curate your timeline to be proven influencers and thinkers, you will benefit significantly from what they're dialoguing on. And occasionally you even get to dialogue with them. The other day I was able to ask Zizan Fleet, the author of Mao's America, I was able to ask her two very important questions to her book. And they were, why is it that Christian universities have fallen into the Marxist DEI trap? And then secondly, why does she think Christianity is the solution? It's because she's not a Christian. And her answer was really interesting. I plan to talk about it later this week, hopefully in a future episode. But I would have never been able to engage with Z in any other format if I had read her book, unless I happened to be able to attend a conference where she was speaking. And so the first reason why you should do a podcast, or at least a practical reason why, is because you actually want to involve yourself in the public discourse. It's not because you want to get a million of followers. Now that might be nice for my income, but it's unlikely. And the main reason why, though, is because you actually want to see if your ideas have weight. That's not the main reason, but that's a practical reason. But the second reason is that if you're a Christian, this void is where most people spend time day to day. I mean, I've talked to some people where all they do is listen to podcasts. They don't even listen to music anymore. They just want to hear more and more ideas. They want to find out what people think. They want to hear human interaction. And I think that's more what it is that they're just, this is becoming the way that we interact with people. And so we're going to have to change the way that we engage. And if the brightest minds, the best that Christianity has to offer, just stays in their ivory towers writing papers that nobody will ever read, then, or pursuing degrees at institutions that force them to learn the woke ideologies, they're going to eventually end up here at some point, especially that last group. Because at some point, you're going to have to push against the ideology. And if you do, you're going to be in trouble. And you're going to have to find an outlet for your ideas, especially if you're willing to sacrifice your career for it. And the best place to do that is the internet. Brett Weinstein comes to mind as well. He's been posting ideas on the internet for a long time. I don't agree with everything that he said. But the bottom line is that this is the place where ideas are battling it out for the minds of people. Elon Musk calls the woke mind virus, he calls wokeism the mind virus, the woke mind virus. And if we want to counteract that, then there has to be a counter idea, antiviral idea to the woke mind virus. And the best way for people of like-mindedness to do that is to have the information out there and make it shareable. And so that's why I started this podcast, is because I did a master's in philosophy. I feel like I have something to offer some people with that education. And I also enjoy just engaging with people on what's going on in the culture. And so I think that the bar is pretty low for why you would need a podcast. But secondly, what came up this week was whether or not churches should have it. And I was talking to some priests after Mass today, and then I was talking with my dad the day before about how live streaming and podcasting has really changed, and how a lot of parishes won't even live stream the Mass, the sacrifice. They won't live stream that aspect, but they will live stream the homily. But I noticed that a more practical approach, because live streaming something requires there to be technical resources there at the event, you know, then they, especially if you're Catholic, then that person has to go to a different service and you got to organize all this stuff, and it can be a real headache. But the same thing would go for other groups too, especially if those groups want to foster community. If they want to encourage people to be there on Sunday, to be there for the actual gathering of people, well, then the obvious solution would be start a podcast and don't live stream your church services. Because the podcast would give you the ability for people to share things out. It's a way for the church to actually engage with parishioners on what's going on, find something out that at your church, somebody has a question, you think, you know, I think the rest of not just this parish or this church, but also like our community might benefit from a discussion on that from a spiritual leader in the community. You can just sit down and you can set up your podcast equipment and you can just go for it. So I think, you know, for, you know, any pastors or priests or leaders in the churches, I really think that this model of no streaming but podcast has a lot of practical advantages to it, because it's lower cost and you also increase people's ability to share out your church and what it's doing and its mission and vision. It's much easier to get somebody to listen to a 15-minute discussion on something they care about than the homily that you wrote for the community. And then the last thing is that it also means your homilies can stay completely and totally relevant to the community, or your sermons, whatever denomination you are. Your sermons, your homilies can stay relevant to the struggles and issues of that community. But your podcast can talk about all of the things that are happening in the world at large that everybody else is consuming on the internet, because they want to know what Christian leaders think about these things. And that oftentimes is going to be the red flags or the green flags that they're looking for in your sermons anyway. So anyway, I think that it could be interesting where things go, but that's why we're doing the podcast. We're also going to change it up a little bit. I think we're going to try for or why churches should do it. And then, you know, the thing that we're going to be doing here on Solomon's Corner is hopefully providing you with something to think about, something, hopefully it will make you laugh at least once. I try to crack enough jokes throughout this whole process and funny stories, but also give you hope. Those are the three goals of every episode we do. And so I hope that you'll think, you'll laugh, and you'll find some hope. All right, so let's get on to what's happening on X. So this is a segment here that my wife and I were talking about, that, you know, when you're trying to do a podcast, little dirty secret here, you want it to be as easy as possible. So, and as organic as possible, as little prep. Like basically our goal is to be able to come down here, turn on the camera and just start talking. So these are the things that I felt like talking about, which, you know, could be foolish, could be interesting. But this is what Jeremy Boring posted this week, and I responded to him on here we go, I got the slides mixed up. This is what Jeremy Boring and prenups is what this part is about, and what he discussed was the idea of, well, let me pull up the tweet here for you. So here's his tweet here, and he says, a prenup is a wonderful thing that makes marriage more likely to succeed because it reduces the economic incentive for one spouse to leave their marriage. Guarding against bad incentives is no different than guarding your heart, except that it sounds worse and is actually more effective. It also codifies the marriage contract by making it, you know, a marriage contract. Gotta love the sarcasm there that makes everybody feel like they're an idiot. It lets you define your marriage prospectively instead of the state defining it after the fact. It is a millennia-old custom practiced by religious Christians and Jews. I would not marry without one. I mean, I did, but I would not advise it now. So this is his approach to this. And just so that people don't, you know, I Googled it. No shame in that. You can Google it as well. I'm going to take away. Jeremy on X. And if I say those interchangeably, it's just because I was on there when it was Twitter. And so Twitter, X, whatever. What I said to him was, and I got some responses back from people who were divorced, but I did not get a response back from Jeremy. I was kind of hoping he would clarify, because let me just say first, this is not going to be about the morality of divorce per se. The Catholic Church says you can't get divorced, but I would recommend reading the Catechism, because there's nuances in there on civil divorce, separation. But the idea that marriage is between a man and a woman for eternity is definitely part of the teaching of the church. But what we're going to be talking about is just whether or not Jeremy Boring actually is solving a problem. Does the prenup solution actually offset the burdens of economic incentives, or as he says, let me pull it up again here real quick. To reference that occasionally, but the thing is that, you know, if marriage is really supposed, there's a couple things wrong with this approach. First of all, there is, if people were saying on X, like, well, you know, your wife could go crazy and get schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or whatever. Okay, fine. Yeah, if you want to come together and say, well, I want a prenup in case you go insane and become a psychotic person. Well, yeah, that's out of their control. Nobody would have, you know, might be a little, all right, well, maybe this person is really, really, you know, maybe they're a lawyer, maybe they're financial advisor or something like that, and they're just thinking that out. But I don't think that's what Jeremy Boring means. I think he means that the system is set up in such a way that your wife, because we're talking about men here, specifically in the context, but that your wife has more incentives to divorce you than to stay with you, which I don't doubt. But the question is, okay, so your solution to this, to ensure that marriages succeed, is to start off with assuming that your wife will be a gold digger if you're successful. Now, I haven't read a lot of marriage books, but I've read enough. And I don't believe that any marriage book starts off, now, chapter one, prenups. You know, you need to understand that your wife could totally stab you in the back. You know, you're real excited. She's pretty. You're handsome. You know, you both love God. You both love movies. You love cooking together. Sparks are fine, but just remember that's going to fade. And one day, if she wants to, she can take you for everything you've got. Okay. But the bottom line is, the reason why this is kind of absurd is because everybody understands that, just practically speaking, if you couldn't trust your wife, you probably shouldn't marry your wife, and vice versa. Like, especially Christians. So the way that this breaks down is that I think, number one, it presumes that our understanding of marriage and our discernment about it should actually be more surrounding what's going on in the state rather than what the church and God say about what is required for a successful marriage. And Paul, the apostle, is very clear, St. Paul, in Ephesians 5:25, that husbands are supposed to love their wives the way that Christ loved the church, and wives are supposed to submit to their husbands. Now, that's a dirty word today. You know, everybody tries to reinterpret submission as, well, actually, it means that the woman can run the household and the man is supposed to keep his mouth shut because if he opens his mouth, he's angry. That's an exaggeration. But the bottom line is that everybody who approaches that passage typically emphasizes the submission issue, and they don't like that. So they try to interpret it in a way that either completely makes it irrelevant so that there's never a situation where a woman has to usually they're worried about abuse or something like that, but it's gotten elevated to a point where, you know, the concern is actually just the woman should never have to do anything she doesn't want to do because they're concerned about this abuse. And yeah, you shouldn't just like your husband can't abuse you. Like that would violate his part of the covenant, which is to love you as Christ loves the church. So this is a mutual covenant of two persons giving everything about them, body, soul, one flesh. They are giving everything that they have to this union called a marriage. And so, yes, there's a risk for that. But the reason why the risks are there is to make sure that the wife and the husband are counting the cost and that they really actually do love each other. Because love is going to be the only thing that makes that marriage successful, not a prenup or anything like that. If we suddenly start saying, well, now we have to have a prenup, you're undermining the foundation of a successful marriage, which is trust. And from that trust, you're willing to give that person your love. And so once you enter into that, the opportunities for more trust and more respect breeds this love that is so real that it becomes a child, as Michael Knowles has said often. Got to give him credit. I never heard that. He was the first one I heard that from. But so what this prenup does is that it actually undermines the Christian definition of marriage and just makes it a state thing. Because now we're just saying, well, you know, at the end of the day, I know the Bible says you're not supposed to get divorced, but, you know, that was an old book and people get divorced. I mean, just look at the stats. Well, maybe it's because people just aren't willing to acknowledge and judge people, because you're not supposed to judge, according to what a virtuous woman and a virtuous man are. And yeah, they might be slim pickings, but you also should be going to the places where those people actually are. If, you know, I was listening to Father Mike Schmitz the other day on Catechism in a Year, and he had a crazy statistic about Catholic families that practice natural family planning, go to confession on a regular basis, and participate in the Eucharist. It's like something like that. So, like, basically the idea was that they're practicing Catholics, like, to the extent that they actually take the fertility of marriage as a moral obligation. And so he said that their divorce rate is like maybe 4% or something crazy like that compared to the 50% of everybody else. And so the reason why that I think that's significant is because the state's not telling people they have to have babies, and they're not telling people that they can't get divorced. It's saying the actual opposite. Like, you should have as few kids as possible. You should understand that your marriage is likely to divorce multiple times probably, and so you should get a prenup. But if we allow the definitions of the risks and the solutions to a successful marriage be determined by the secular world, then we're undermining, again, the Christian authority to define what a marriage is and what's required for its success. So that's the first problem. Like, I don't think Christians are going to just buy into this. I think that, well, maybe they will. I mean, who knows? But if they do, it's going to be to their own detriment, because they're going to, again, concede more ground that the state determines what the nature of marriage is, not to the degree that the LGBTQ movement did, but it's, again, conceding even more ground. But this time, in the actual male-female relationship this time. And so you have Christians, just like the feminists did, say, well, I don't really have to submit. Now you have men saying, well, I don't really have to give my life for you. I mean, it's a metaphor. Jesus saying that you're supposed to give your life for your wife, like being willing to die for her, you know, as long as she's good, as long as she's a good submissive wife, that's when you're supposed to die for her. Well, that's not what Jesus did. So I just think that it's possible, you know, again, I'd like to hear Jeremy talk about this because I love the Daily Wire guys. I definitely don't think that Michael Knowles or Matt Walsh would agree with it, you know, but they're kind of like, you know, they got to pick their battles. But, you know, again, if you're talking prenups, like in the non-traditional sense that, you know, you just want to, yeah, if my wife gets hit by a rock and then she turns into a schizophrenic nutso, okay, yeah, sure, work that makes sense. Yeah, be prudent. Okay, yeah, you and 1% of everybody else who thinks that's a real likelihood. But the last thing is that in the secular world, why would they get a prenup? The only reason why non-Christians get married anyway is just because they were immersed in a Christian culture. And as we've seen, lots of people just say, well, if I'm having sex, why get married anyway? In fact, there's even in the catechism, there's a whole thing on free unions. And just this week, somebody sent me an email asking, well, can a man and a woman just tell each other that they're never going to leave each other and then tell God that they're committed and then have sex and say they're married? They were asking for biblical arguments for that. I don't think that there are any. Because largely the way that we do marriages today are based on tradition. But for the Catholics, it's based on the authority of the church, that there has to be a priest present there to bless the sacrament. So there are no such things as free unions. But in the secular world, that's a lot less risky. So again, the question is, do prenups actually solve the problem of failing marriages? No, because the reason why marriages are failing is because people are ultimately selfish. That's why a woman might divorce her husband and take him for everything he's got, especially if he gets rich. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody does that. I'm not saying that. It's just that in this context, that's the kind of thing that a prenup is supposed to protect against. And so the secular world looks at this and says, well, gosh, if the Christians think that marriage is basically a risky contract where you could just get screwed out of everything. Well, I'm already sleeping with her. We already live together. Why even bother going through with it? And so I think that if the prenup culture actually takes off, I think it's going to actually just do more damage to marriage than good. It's not going to make things more successful, that's for sure. And especially if, you know, somebody who's got a lot of influence like Jeremy Boring or any other conservative out there says, yeah, you should get a prenup. Well, they're going to Google it. They're going to find Forbes, and that's what they're going to see. They're going to see, oh, you're supposed to, like, save your estate and those kinds of things. And again, I don't think that you have to be totally concerned. We're living in the era of the internet. It's not like, you know, this is some shady discussion. It's just what he thinks. And I don't think that people should curb what they think, especially if they think it's a good thing, because somebody else is going to not take responsibility for their own actions and decisions. But in the end, I just think the prenup thing is just not going to work. And, you know, because again, its goal is to succeed, that to make successful marriages. And I think that's pretty much everything that I've got on that. Oh yeah. One last thing is it's just funny to me. It's like, okay, it doesn't take into account age either. You know, I got married when I think I was like 23. My wife was around 20. And if I had gone to her dad, he had a list of questions for me, like a whole list of like 25 questions that him and his buddies had come up with in that conversation. If I had said, yeah, you know, I also want to get a prenup, well, who knows? I mean, maybe he would have been okay with it. I don't know. But I know that, you know, there are plenty of dads out there that definitely would not give their daughter in marriage if he found out that the son-in-law to be had drafted a prenup for her before she gets married. Like, how's that conversation gonna go? Yes, I'd like to sleep with your daughter, and also, if things don't work out, there's no risk to me. Yeah, I don't think that's going to work, bud. Anyway, yeah, maybe when you're 35, 40, but, you know, at that point, like, you don't have, you know, you're not going to be married for 50 years anyway, you know, so, well, maybe you will be, you know, but with the way life expectancy is going down, I doubt it. Anyway, so let's go on to the next. The post that I had was this guy here. I got my Finder open. You guys are seeing the... I'm going to shut this stuff. There we go. All right, you guys should be able to see my screen now. Okay, so I posted this thing on IVF, and the reason why I did was because this IVF thing was going around. Jack Prosabik, who's a Catholic, saw that Trump had kind of gotten soft on the IVF issue because of an Alabama law or something like that that had just passed, saying that the embryos in that are conceived in IVF are considered lives, human life. And so this is going to have an effect on the IVF industry. So Carrie Lake, Trump, you know, the usual conservative influencers jumped on it and said, you know, because they want to be moderate, and they're trying to not look extreme to get more votes for, you know, the primary. And Jack Prosabik came out and said, you know, the way forward is for there to be adoptions and, you know, not to keep people from being able to have this technology to be able to have kids. First of all, this issue, just like the last issue, is a very sensitive issue. I'm not trying to downplay anybody's difficulties with kids. I'm not trying to downplay anybody's trying to make a inference about you know, the ease or that, you know, the issue is that it's really hard to deal with fertility problems. So I'm not trying to be insensitive, but we also have to be sensitive to the fact that children are dying in the process. And then secondly, that Christians are also involved in supporting this. And so I posted this thing, which was basically, you know, kind of a little informative post about the fact that three major influencers in the last 70 years all recognized that contraceptive technologies were giving the impression that man was becoming more and more like a god. And such to the fact that Yuval Noah Harari, who's wrote the book Homo Deus, which is, you know, Latin for man god, and also says on, like, it is not an exaggeration. He believes technology will eventually cause human beings to become gods. And you can look it up. We're not going to get into it now, but like he's not a fringe thinker. Obama endorsed him. Okay. And his books, he's spoken. And if you look at his website, look at all of the world leaders that he's consulted with. He is not some, you know, Alex Jones for the transhumanist movement. But the other two people that recognize this were also C.S. Lewis and Hannah Arendt. And again, this technology, IVF specifically, was recognized by Yuval in his book Homo Deus. This is the first page of his book with the caption, In Vitro Fertilization, Mastering Creation. And the reason why this is significant is because Yuval's not on the Christian team. And yet the promise to Adam and Eve in the garden from the devil was, you know, if you eat of this tree, you will be as gods. The moment you start to see those who are antagonistic to your view making progress towards something that you also making progress towards something that the devil used as a lie or a deception, you may want to rethink your position, morally speaking. And in this case, the shared subject is IVF. If Yuval is looking at these ideas of IVF, these new technologies, and seeing them as steps towards man no longer needing God, which he says openly, you may want to think twice about whether or not you participate in said technologies. But even further, Hannah Arendt and C.S. Lewis were very different thinkers, and they both recognized the same phenomenon in their books, The Abolition of Man, which is a fairly easier book, and The Human Condition. And so at the end of the day, these two books, again, Jordan Peterson said this once, you know, when you find people who are from different backgrounds, totally different ideologies, and they're all zeroing in on the same conclusion, the same truth claim, there's a good chance that that's true. And the thing that all three of these people are recognizing is that contraceptive technologies are destroying the human person. C.S. Lewis says that. Hannah Arendt does to a certain extent, maybe not as explicit as C.S. Lewis, but she says that the technology, the priests of our age are the scientists. They're the ones who hold the moral authority now. And Homo Deus, Yuval Noah Harari, says, yes, in order for man to become something else, he's going to have to cast off his human nature. So all three of them recognize that these technologies are having basically the same effect. It's just a question of who thinks it's good and who thinks it's bad. And from the Christian perspective, Hannah Arendt saying that the scientists are the ones who hold the moral authority, this is definitely true for a lot of American Christians, Catholic and Protestant, but you know, the Protestants at least have kind of an excuse for it, because they believe that, you know, Scripture alone and their human reason are kind of what determine the moral order for their personal lives. Now, there are people who will push back on that. Protestantism is big and very, very much contradictory in nature. But in Catholics, it's interesting when you talk to a Catholic, they know what the church teaches because they want to know if they can get an excuse for what they know, whether that's abortion, IVF, or whatever. So they know what the church teaches on these things oftentimes. Now, not everybody does, but, you know, like Jack Posobiec definitely knows the teaching on IVF. He's claimed himself as a devout Catholic. He knows that that is against church teaching. He knows that. And the reason why it's against church teaching and why it's considered immoral across even Protestant circles is because you're not without an excuse on this procedure. It's almost analogous to the temptation of Christ in the desert, where the devil makes these deals with Christ. And what is he appealing to? He's appealing to a lot of things that are oftentimes attractive to us. You know, you're hungry. You know, you should sin so that you can eat. You should exercise this divine power, you know, to satisfy yourself. Or you have the, you know, if you bow down and worship me, you know, you can have all these kingdoms or whatever. And it's no different than the fact that the Antichrist oftentimes uses, there's a quote from this movie, The Hidden Life. It says the Antichrist uses our virtues against us. And the guy who's saying that is actually a bad guy. But in the end, he's not wrong. And that's one of the deceptive aspects of the Christian spiritual war we find ourselves in, is that it's a good thing to want kids. It's a good thing to want marriage. It's a good thing to see a woman who's beautiful and recognize it as such. It's not a good thing to get kids at any cost, because they're not property. They're not cars. They're not cell phones. You don't just go buy one off the shelf. And if you don't believe that that's what people are doing like that, watch some of the LGBT videos who use similar technologies for surrogacy and are selecting people's genetic profiles to decide what kind of child they want, just like you would a car. So these technologies are antithetical to the Christian way of life. They kill children. They leave them in a kind of like weird frozen state of life. Like, we know that those are our children in there. And then they are either donated to science, which is pretty sketch, you know, as far as like the human donation process to science, that's not a humane thing to do. And the problem is that nobody is without an excuse on this stuff. When they go through these procedures, because I've known multiple people who have gone through this, they have to sign off on what they're going to do with the leftover embryos, because nobody wants a Kate plus eight situation anymore. And so the issue is that no one is without excuse on this. And that makes these sins particularly problematic, because you know what you're doing. And it does have an impact on people's spiritual life. I can testify to that with all the people I've seen go through this. It changes their view of God. It changes their view of a human person. And the only solution to that is not to let IVF continue. It's to recognize the dignity of human persons and then ask ourselves, well, what is permissible for my Christian walk given what a human person is and what God says they are in his word and what the church teaches on that? Because IVF is just, it's not a good practice. And you don't even have to be Catholic to recognize it. If you believe that life begins at conception and you think IVF is okay to do, you are blatantly contradicting God's requirement that we not murder people. You are breaking one of the Ten Commandments. And like the Bible says, if you sin against one of them, you sin against all of them. And so it's vital that Christians understand that this is not just like, you know, oh, whoopsie, you know, well, I might have sinned, but now I got my kid, so I guess I'm good. I would just be really cautious about having that attitude on this subject. But anyway, this got blocked, and so, you know, and in the Catholic Church, it's a mortal sin. And that leads me to the last section that we have today on what happened. And one of the things that's been weird about this whole time that we're in is that people are, non-Christians are coming to a conclusion about church teaching, specifically moral church teaching. Not the full thing, but there's these very prominent thinkers like Elon Musk and Jordan Peterson and maybe less known, but James Lindsay. And they're starting to, and even Joe Rogan to a certain extent, they're starting to see the reasonableness of Catholic social teaching. Now, they might not know it as such. They might not want to go to all the implications, but that is the route that they are going down. The most prominent one would be on birth control. Oops, hold on. I lost you guys. Just a second. I accidentally put you in the screensaver there. Come on. Come back. That's what happens when you're low budget. All right. There we go. So hormonal birth control, Elon Musk posted this the other day. For those that don't know, you can't use hormonal birth control or any form of contraceptives according to the Catholic Church. And you do natural family planning, but again, we're not going to get into the, well, isn't it the same? And blah, blah. No, it's not. Father Mike Schmitz did a great talk on it. Go listen to the Catechism in a Year. The point that I'm trying to draw up here is that when we were growing up in the church and when we were considering getting married, my wife and I, and we had gotten engaged, the first thing that people started talking to us about was, you gonna jump on the pill? You're going to, like, what are you guys going to do for birth control? People were asking her and me the whole time. And it was only because of a Catholic that we ended up not going with contraceptives, and actually an atheist. we were considering some methods that, again, we didn't know. And one of my wife's friends, I don't know if she's an atheist, it's been a while, but she said, yeah, I don't think you want to go through with that because you're a Christian and like, you don't want that method. I think it was an IUD or something like that. And birth control is just not safe, like at all. And it was something that was like, I can remember distinctly that, you know, Christians were just like, it was just kind of like a thing. Nobody considered the history of it. Nobody considered the origins of it. In fact, when I first started hearing about the origins of it, Jordan Peterson was the one who was talking about it. Jordan Peterson's not even Christian. He made a claim several years ago that birth control was probably the most influential technology. I think he said this multiple times. Influential technology to date, because it radically changed our perceptions of what it meant to be a woman. And because it disrupted the natural order to that degree. For the first time ever, women didn't have to think about their lives in light of their natural purpose, which was childbearing. Like, and people don't like that, but that is what separates men and women. One can have a child, the other one can give a child. And so, you know, one can birth a child, the other one can impregnate a woman. Like that's those are the differences in terms of gender, or in terms of biological sex. And so when you're looking at the fact that, wow, so this is what the Catholic Church teaches on that, and Elon Musk says this, huh, that's weird. And then you look at the fact that a lot of people said, I only want two kids. A lot of Christians said they only want two kids. In fact, when we had our twins, they were boy-girl twins, the first thing that somebody came up to me and said was, so you done now? You got your boy and your girl. And even still, we were a family of six kids, and it was a regular occurrence, according to my parents, that people would look at them funny for having as many kids as they had. That, like, and again, the church teaching was always there that if you're going to be married, that your marriage is primarily for the raising and educating of children. And it was in there. But it was mocked a lot of times by Protestants as this arbitrary rule or whatever, that you weren't supposed to, that it didn't matter. It's just the church trying to, you know, push you on it. And now you've got another form of racism coming in. Racism is another mortal sin. And James Lindsay is the one who's pushing against that. He's an agnostic, and he was part of the neo-atheists to a certain extent. He was with Peter Boghossian for a while, and now he's at church conferences trying to get Christians to wake up about what DEI is and how racist it is, because as many are saying that are not Christians, that the only antidote that they can see to Marxism is Christianity, even though they don't believe it. That's what Zizan Fleet says in her book, Mao's America. And also what she said to me when I asked her on X a couple weeks ago. And so the nature of these channels, and I think she may have said it on Tucker. Actually, she was just on Tucker too, so you can go check that out. But what hit me was, as you know, as I was preparing for my first confession, I was going through the exercise on a reflection of conscience. And what that is, for those that don't know, is that you before you go into confession, you're reflecting over the sins that you may have done. And for your first confession, it's the sins that you have done for your entire life that you can remember. And I was going through what in the book that they gave us, they broke down, you know, this is what a mortal sin is, this is what a venial sin is. And without getting into the theological implications of that, essentially, just to summarize, a venial sin doesn't cause you to lose your status of grace with God, but a mortal sin does put you in a state that's no longer in the grace of God. And so in order to alleviate that, you need to go to confession. Now, most people don't understand that a mortal sin, there's criteria behind that, and we're not going to get into that. If you want me to get into that, you know, you can, I'm happy to do it. You can find it yourself. You can go to the Catechism of the Catholic Church. It's not a secret. You can just go find these things yourself. Or if you want to listen to a priest talk about it, go to Father Mike Schmitz. He talks about it, gives great examples of what they are and how, why people mix them up sometimes. So we're not going to do that here. But basically, what happened to me was I was looking at the list of mortal sins, and I realized like the most prominent people currently telling the world to avoid mortal sins, the most prominent people, that doesn't mean Christians aren't, but the most prominent people on Twitter, I mean, Elon Musk has something like, last I checked, 160 million followers on X. And he has told people to have lots of kids and get away from birth control. Jordan Peterson is another person who said the other day that to be the most sane, you should be Catholic. And at the end of the day, these issues are, people will say, I don't think mortal sins exist. But where I'm going with this is that mortal sins clearly do exist, at least at the political level, because they will destroy your society. So if mortal sins are so bad that they can affect your status with God, according to the Catholic Church, wouldn't they also have material effects too? Meaning that they might actually have an effect on civilization? And what all of these non-Christians are recognizing is that, and none of them have tied this back to the Catholic Church. It was just my reflection on conscience that kind of caused this epiphany, that non-Christians are recognizing the threat of mortal sins that the church has taught on for a long, 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 long time. And that has to give some weight to the authority of the church, that especially if you grew up Protestant and a lot of these mortal sins were just seen as essentially sins that are not that big of a deal, as long as you just say, God, I'm sorry, you know, no worries. And again, I don't think that people do it that flippantly necessarily. I think some people do have a heartfelt contrition to God for these things. But there has to be, some credit given to the claims of the Catholic Church, given the fickleness of human reason, how often we get things wrong, that they didn't just get one right or two right, but got a lot of things right. Abortion, IVF, surrogacy, those three alone are sacred cows on the left. They've got, and to a certain extent on the right too, having lots of kids. If you don't have lots of kids, you don't have a nation, you definitely don't have a church. Racism reemerging as a mortal sin. And the fact that the non-Christians are the ones leading the charge on this should make all of us really think hard about that passage that Paul says, you should work out your salvation with fear and trembling. Because if the church is not going to, or leaders are not going to call these sins what they are and educate people on what they are, that's not good for anybody. And it's not good for the pastors. It's not good for the priests. It's not good for any Christian leader, because, you know, Jesus said, if you lead one of these little ones astray, you're going to have a millstone around your neck. And it's not good for any of the people who may have lesser culpability because they aren't the leaders, because they still have to deal with the consequences of the sin, and they are absolutely tragic. So maybe we'll do more on that, more in depth on, you know, how these pagans are recognizing the mortal sins by their reason and what those implications are for society. But the last thing I wanted to talk about was the Pray 40 challenge with Hallow. And I think that what we're going to do is, you know, every time we do this, I'm going to kind of give an update on the books I'm reading and some of the things that we've discovered in those readings and observations and stuff. So if you have a book you want me to cover or you want me to reflect on, put it in the comments below and I'll definitely consider it. But the book I'm reading right now is He Leadeth Me by Father Walter Chizik. And I discovered this because of the Pray 40 challenge on Halo. And I'm just going to plug Halo for a second because I really thought that the thing was cheesy when I saw the ads, not the Super Bowl ones with Marky Mark. You know, Mark Wahlberg, for those that don't know. A lot of people don't know that he was a rapper first. But he was. Marky Mark. Look it up. And so anyway, the first thought that I had was that somebody's going to go visit a Catholic church because Marky Mark told them, you know, something about the Catholic faith that's not true. And then they get to RCIA and they're like, well, Marky Mark told me, though, on the Halo. But it's actually not like that. It's a really good study. They're not pulling any punches about what it means to be a Christian. And I think that that's why it's so successful. I think the last time I checked, they had over 1 million people engaging in this prayer challenge for Lent, including people like Russell Brand. And, you know, and then the other thing I thought was when I saw Michael Knowles advertising Halo and Matt Walsh advertising Halo. Michael Knowles is a traditional Latin mass Catholic. I doubt he's using Halo, just saying. You know, use the promo codes that he has, but I I doubt it. And then Matt Walsh just doesn't strike me as a guy who's going to pull up a prayer app on his phone. But those were the two guys who were advertising it. But the thing that I thought was interesting about Walter Chizik was that the book that they chose was all about the suffering in the Gulag from a Christian perspective. And if you have watched some of our older episodes, you know that I have done a lot on Gulag, on Solzhenitsyn, Czesław Miłosz, and the Polish Soviet occupation and the difference between that and the Nazis. And so this was refreshing because it was a lot of it was the Christian perspective of what it was like to be in the Gulag. And he was in the worst part. Solzhenitsyn says that if you ended up in the labor camps, you had an 80% chance of survival, or a 20% chance of survival, basically. He talks about the guys who worked on the White Basin Canal, like hundreds of thousands of people died literally freezing to death, standing up. And so, you know, the conditions that Walter Chizik was in, Father Walter Chizik was in, were just really, really bad. And, you know, some of the things that he says, people have said before in Christianity, but they're saying them from a place of comfort, and so they don't really stick, but they're bumper sticker slogans. And they're not really sticking. And then when Father Walter Chizik says, yeah, and so I was in solitary confinement for 5 years, and that's when I realized that God had broken me and I had to surrender everything to him. Like, how many times have you heard surrender everything to him? Surrender everything to God. Well, yeah, working on it, but what does that really mean? If you want to know what that means, buy the book He Leadeth Me, because I don't think I've read a better book on the subject, and especially if you're concerned about what's going on in the world right now. You know, journalists are getting arrested for writing articles. The border is getting flooded. I've met two people since we moved to Ohio who have lost loved ones because of the fentanyl crisis. And, you know, this is, we're just in a real dark period in our nation's history, and we don't know to what extent God's going to ask us to be touched by that. It's going to be different for everybody. But if you're finding yourself nervous and not able to surrender, I highly recommend the book, and I highly recommend the Pray 40 Challenge. It is really, really good. And if you don't like the idea of paying for a Christian app, I'm just going to say it's worth every penny in terms of its quality. I mean, it's really setting the bar for what Christians should do in terms of application development. And I say that as somebody who's a developer. But anyway, so the one thing I wanted to bring up, though, was that there were two things I wanted to bring up, and I'm trying to get through them really quickly. Is that number one is communism being a religion, and number two, the Catholic doctrine being part of how he was able to get the reflections that he got. And so the first thing is that, you know, a lot of us will say communism is a religion, but we don't really know, you know, if you ask somebody, well, what is a religion? A lot of people don't really know what a religion is. But they know it when they see it. You know, they understand. Well, Catholics are definitely religious. Muslims are religious. Jews are religious. Non-denominational Christians might be religious. Maybe. We're not sure. But they definitely are. They're definitely Christians. They're definitely worshiping God and stuff. But there's something that comes to mind when we think of a religious person. You know, somebody who's willing to, you know, for example, wear their religion on their sleeve. Or, you know, if you're a fan of Ben Shapiro, I like Ben Shapiro, you know, he has a yarmulke and he's talked about why he wears one all the time. Or priests and their collars, you know, or Catholics and their rosaries. Like, you can spot these people by the matter or the stuff, that the physical stuff that they use to designate themselves. You can spot a communist too, hammer and sickle. But you can also spot them by their practices. Like, they seem to venerate things or praise things, or even in some cases worship their political leaders, right? And so what does that look like? And, you know, it's easy to say communism is a religion and Catholics are a religion. And you can even read The Captive Mind and you can see how the communists co-opted a lot of Catholic practices to give the impression of kind of a deification of these communist leaders like Stalin and Lenin. But I hadn't read anything that really kind of drove the point home. And when Father Walter Chizik is in the interrogation, he ends up having a moment with the interrogator where they start to argue about Catholicism and communism. And Father Chizik says that the interrogator was trying to convince him to become a communist and to work with them against the church. So he says here, the interrogator explained how easy it would be for him to arrange that I join and become a member of the Orthodox Church, and also to arrange for me to have a platform from which I might denounce the Pope. He stressed how the Orthodox Church, unlike the Catholic Church, had condemned fascism and was helping the government in the war against totalitarianism. But the popes had attacked communism, especially Pius XII, who surely must secretly sympathize with Mussolini and Hitler. That led to long arguments about the church. Finally, I, Father Chizik, managed to convince him that the Catholic Church was, to me, at least as meaningful as the Communist Party was to him. I felt toward her, the church, the same sense of loyalty and allegiance that he felt to the Communist Party. I could not help it. It was part of me. So we agreed to disagree, and I felt I had won another round. And the significance of that is the fact that the appeal that Father Chizik is making is a religious appeal, that like, that I have to give everything I have to this. My whole body, my whole soul, like everything has to be given to the church. And the point at which they find common ground is that the Communist Party has asked the same of the interrogator. You have to give us everything. In fact, one of the things that Solzhenitsyn talked about was the fact that many communists were in the gulag. In fact, if you read In the First Circle, one of the main characters, I believe his name is Rubin, is a communist who believes that he was rightly put into the gulag because he had failed the party and he was serving a kind of penance. So the brainwashing goes so deep on this stuff. And this is why I think this is the first time I've read any quote that showed that communism was very much like a religion. And so the last thing I want to touch on here is that, and I'm going to do this quick because I want to try and do this in less than 5 minutes, is that I noticed as I was coming into the Catholic faith that people would, I would share a story of a saint or a Catholic compared to, and their story and struggle. And what I found in Catholic stories were a lot of incredibly powerful stories that were completely and totally tied to some sort of doctrine of the church. So St. Maximilian Kolbe has a profound life. He was a real person. He was a recent person. He's in living memory. If you go to Auschwitz, you will find a memorial to him there. And his devotion to Mary was so strong that even some of his Catholic brothers were kind of saying, hey, man, like, taking it too far. But then when you read about his life in the concentration camp in Nazi Germany, this is Father Max Feeling Colby, not to be confused with Father Chizik. I'm just trying to make a point here. He is incredibly Christ-like, and more so than I think any of us would ever dare to think that we would be. And that is not even considering all of the God moments, we would say, that occurred during his ministry. And people will try and brush that off. Oh yeah, well, you know, there's a lot of crazy Christians out there. You know, there's some weird ones. And, you know, they weren't right on everything. Yeah, yeah, I understand. But the problem is that for a Catholic, you can know what parts they were right on and what parts they weren't. And it's very, very clear, because it's either a dogma or it's not. And in the case of Father Walter Chizik, you know, the reflections he has should not be just chalked up to reason. When he gets to the section on the body, he says that he had learned so much about the body, and he says, the spirit is willing. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. How often during the long years in the labor camps did I think of that scripture text, sometimes in a spirit of gentle irony, but mostly in the agony of piercing bodily pain or the despair of total exhaustion. And how often during those years did I think of how much the body means to man, how essential its well-being is to his well-being, how prominent a part in every activity of human existence is played by that clay into which God first breathed the breath of life. Man is a creature composed of body and soul. We have recited that truth from the day we first learned our catechism. But until the body fails us, or pains us, or forces itself upon our attention by some little twinge or complete collapse, we tend to take for granted the first and most precious of God's gifts to man, or to give it short shrift. Then he says, my second day in the labor camps was one of those days. Which just says to you how bad it was. He's not even past day two. And this is a reflection that he has from that time. But the reason why I bring this up is because if you were to ask for a robust theology on the body and the soul from most pastors, they won't be able to give it. Probably even, maybe even some priests. But you can find a deep and robust teaching on it from either popes or from the catechism on the Catholic Church. And there's no doubt that it's ingrained in that. Now, you'll find the occasional Protestant, like it's part of the teaching of the church institutionally. And you can find people in the Protestant worlds, individuals who will hold to the teaching of the Catholic Church on this issue, but not that issue or whatever, which is fine because that's what we all do. We all take these, you know, we say, well, yes, I will believe this. I won't believe that. But when it comes to the Catholic Church, you're submitting to the things that even may not seem entirely clear because you're saying that they have this authority to say what is and what isn't the teaching of the church. And the body and soul distinction is one of those things. And what you see in the lives of these saints, is that they, you know, some Protestant's going to be like, he slipped. Yeah, they're all lies. I'm just kidding. That the doctrines of the church were what helped him, what God used to frame the lessons that he eventually distills to us in this book. And so he says, that we survived under the circumstances is a tribute to the stubbornness and power of the human will driving the body beyond what a man thought he could endure, and a tribute as well to the marvelous work of God's creation that is the human body. No machine ever devised by man could have withstood day in and day out the constant punishing grind of work in the severest kind of weather that the human body proved itself able to withstand in the Siberian slave labor camps. It is customary to speak of the indomitable human spirit as that which carries man through crises like this, but the body surely merits more attention than it usually gets. Not the trained, beautifully conditioned body of the athlete, but the weak, underfed, and ordinary body with which we are all endowed. It was under the daily regimen of work to exhaustion in the camps, under the constant torture of hunger and cold, through hurt and pain, distress and disease, weariness beyond comprehension, and endurance beyond belief, that I came to truly understand and appreciate the catechism truth that man is a creature composed of body and soul. And so I bring this up because there's even more reflections on that, but we don't have time to get to them. When, especially for Protestants who are reading Catholics, don't scrub them of their Catholicity. You got to wrestle with the fact that this is how God works in Catholics. And that is something that was very disturbing to me as a Protestant. But it is the case, and I know that's it's a crazy claim to make, God does do miracles with Protestants. I'm not saying that. He does take them through profound experiences to teach them the lessons like what Father Chizik had. However, with reading some of the saints and what God did through them, it is just, it does bring more glory to God in a sense of the fact that their stories actually reveal a truth, a very specific truth, a very Catholic truth. And oftentimes they're accompanied by miracles. And if we reflect on St. Paul, when he was Saul first, he had a very, very specific interpretation of the Old Testament. Mainly that if you were nailed to a tree, you were accursed. So how could Jesus be the Messiah? And it took a miracle for God to actually change his interpretation of that passage. And I don't know a single Christian out there that will say that their interpretation of the Bible is perfect. In fact, my dad would say, you know, it's not the things that I know to be true in the Bible that are concerning to me. What concerns me is the things that I think are true, but I'm wrong about. Those are the ones that concern me. Well, the only thing that's going to, you know, for anybody who's shares that concern, the only thing that's going to shake you from that is if God actually still acts in time and space, if he actually still creates saints here on earth, and if somebody actually catalogs those stories. And so anyway, that's all I got for today. I hope that you guys enjoyed this. This is the first podcast in a while. I definitely went 10 minutes over, but had some technical difficulties. So, but I really appreciate you guys sticking it out to the end. Thank you so much for listening, and hopefully we'll have another episode next week. I'm Daniel Roberts. This is Solomon's Corner. Keep thinking.